talk about is Senate File 638, Senator Scheid, prop payment requirement for construction subcontractors. Welcome to the committee. Well, you're on this committee, but...
Mr. Chairman, I am.
Welcome.
Soon you forget.
Geraldine, I will never forget you. Oh, no, Linda. Okay, we have a little, try to have a little fun here, too, once in a while. Senator Scheid, Senate File 638.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And this should be pretty clear. I think that the chair, yourself, carried a bill back in 1997 having to do with prompt payment and also what's called progress payment, if you recall.
Yes,
that.
I do.
That was my first year in the Senate, and I don't know that I recall it, but
it was a good idea. Chances are maybe I did it then. Yeah.
It was outstanding. And it got bogged down, I think, over progress payment, so there was language added to exclude residential single-family and small townhome-type projects from the prompt payment obligation. And it was excluded with the progress payment. That's one issue. We're addressing only the prompt payment issue. And I think I can tell you that maybe I can distinguish. I'm not sure this is exactly going to be understood by you, but prompt payment is when I, the contractor, get paid, then I have to pay the subcontractors at that time.
When you take the draws, right?
Right.
When you
progress payment is like a fixed payment schedule going through the construction project, and so I guess typically like every 30 days, and then people get their payment. But this is only about prompt payment. It has to do with contractors making prompt payments to the subcontractors who are doing work on their construction. And, and I believe that it's required except when it's residential real estate and when it's, let's see, fewer than 13 units per structure. So a 12-unit structure or single-family home right now is excluded from prompt payment. So all we do in the bill is strike some current language. I'd like to ask a couple of people to testify, and then I'd move the bill.
Okay, we'll hear from a couple folks.
Okay. And Pam, do you want to come up? Which one of you wants to go first?
Welcome to the Minnesota Senate.
Thank you. And then I'll have you.
Just identify yourselves for the tape.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Pam Jewison, and I am a residential subcontractor. My husband and I own an excavating company, Allied Excavating, out of Savage. And I am also the secretary of the board of an organization called MARS, Minnesota Association of Residential Subcontractors and Suppliers. And I'm here today to testify about the prompt payment law that's on the books right now. To give you a little insight of this, my business was formed in 96, it grew as the economy went, and now with it being in a recession, in the last 2 years, I wrote off over $250,000 in bad debt from residential contractors who failed in their obligations to me. I had signed contracts, and I had no laws to fall back on to get prompt payment, to get paid in a timely fashion. They would take draws from the bank or from a finance company and not forward the payment on to myself and other subcontractors working on their projects. And I have to, in my line of business, pay my bills in a timely fashion every 30 days, sometimes 45. If I buy material from a gravel pit, I'm required to pay in 15 days. So I have to pay my bills on a timely fashion, and if I don't, I will get cut off at the pit. They will stop delivering fuel to me until I pay my bills. So I have to take out a loan to pay my bills on time so I can keep my business running. I'm not we need to fix the problem now. We can't go back and recoup my $250,000, but I want it to be good for the future going forward for my kids and my grandkids, who I hope will eventually take over our business and continue on with it. And I look for your support in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Metzen, this gentleman is from Brooklyn Park, where I live. So,
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Aaron Doolittle, and I own Common Solutions, which is a small technology integration business, and I work in both residential and commercial. I started the business in 1997, only working in commercial projects, and I had never had a problem not getting paid. In 2004, I refocused my sales efforts towards residential, and within a couple projects, I already got into the same old problem where we were being asked to forego getting paid on this project, and they'll catch us on the next two. And it wasn't a negotiation. It was something that was imposed upon us. It was only within the residential marketplace that I was harmed by late payments and non-payments. And the result is that I had over $100,000 in losses. The Minnesota Prompt Payment Statute is intended to ensure that businesses are provided that provide the materials and labors are paid. The prompt payment only applies when a prime contractor's actually been paid for the labor that we provide. And the current law, in my opinion, discriminates against small businesses and is against good public policy. I also strongly encourage the passage of this bill.
How would you be aware of when the general would get the draw? I mean, I believe you should get paid, but how would you know the timing of the release of some money from the bank to the general?
Mr. Chairman, we would the contract that I had would call for us to get paid upon invoice when we're done. But we would actually have to wait until closing for the project, and so we'd have to find out from the contractor when the closing date was.
I really didn't answer my question. Yeah.
I'm not sure unless me as a subcontractor wouldn't call the contractor and say, did you get a draw? Otherwise, I have no way of knowing.
That's what I'm saying. I mean,
right.
How would you? Yeah,
yes,
so yeah,
I have no way of knowing.
Are the bankers on board on this? You think they would be, or are they here? Or David, Senator Scheid, have you worked with them at all?
Mr. Chairman,
think that they would want to know, you know, they're putting out the dough up front, and you'd think they'd want to know who that the subs are indeed getting paid, so there's no liens at the end of the day after they've drawn all their money. So just a statement, I guess.
Mr. Chairman, no, that's valid. Ms. Frenette is here from the builders, and I think she would say something. Maybe it would help with the timing issue.
Okay, that's good.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Lisa Frenette with the Builders Association of Minnesota. Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to speak. We do agree with this language. We think it's a good idea. In response to Senator or Chairman Metz's question, we are working on another piece of legislation right now. It actually was introduced today under Senator Scheid that does a few similar things, plus it does a notification provision to lenders that they have to put out, for example, if they're going to stop payments on anything, to let subcontractors know that they're not going to be making any more payments so that subcontractors can stop working on a project. Part of what we're hoping it will do is it will force better and more mechanics liens provisions. It will tell the contractor that they actually have to collect mechanics liens and then give names to the bank so that they understand what's going on, and notices can be handed out. Again, it's in a rough introduction stage, and we're working with the banks on the provision.
Okay, yeah, that would help. Senator Latz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To either of the builders that were here, or Senator Scheid, this is my first exposure to this particular provision in the law. What portion of the statute, the prompt payment to subcontractors subdivision that we have in front of us, do you think has the most teeth or is the most effective in forcing people to pay, other than saying you've got to pay? I mean, there's a 10-day payment requirement, but there are consequences if you don't pay. What do you think are the most effective consequences to non-payment that causes people to comply with the statute, in your experience?
I'm going to ask Ms. Jewison if she can comment on that because I don't personally have any experience with the other things you might have tried to get to collect.
I believe that the wording in there, a party requesting payment who prevails in a civil action, that I can collect interest and attorney's fees, whereas being excluded, I have nothing. And I think attorney's fees, I've found trying to perfect mechanics liens and other civil action, my attorney's fees sometimes outweigh the cost of what I'm owed. So if the other party is required to pay my attorney's fees and interest, it's going to defer them from, because they're going to be out that money also. So it would be in their best interest to pay me before it got to legal action.
Sir, has that been experience as well?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Latz, I agree it would put some teeth into the language that allows us to have the same rights as all the larger subcontractors to get paid. By the way the language says the party must be paid attorney's fees, it would also allow us to potentially get an attorney to take it on a contingency if we can't afford to pay up front.
Senator Bach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Jewison, that $250,000 that you wrote off, did you have all of that under a written contract with other people that just didn't pay you, or was some of it just kind of come do this for me? Or what does that look like?
And Senator Bach, it was all under written contract that stipulated that I was to be paid unless there was issues with my work, and there was never any issues with my work. They just did not pay us.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Jewison, what would be the reasons other than cash flow that a prime contractor would withhold prompt payment to a subcontractor like yourself, other than cash flow? I mean, are there other paperwork that maybe is not in order that might delay the payment, or what would be a contractor's reason? If you pay 20 days instead of 10 days, or is there any reasons that we'd consider, you know, paperwork not being in order or something?
Mr. Chairman, I was just going to say, I'm sure she would have taken the money in 20 days if it had been.
If it had been offered to me in 20 days or even 30 days if they would contact me. But what had been happening is I would build or I would excavate a foundation, and then I could see on the horizon that there would be three or more foundations going to be coming my way. So I would maybe hold off, because then when the other houses got under construction, the money flow would come. But what had happened is, without my knowledge, there were contractors who put up 5, 6, 7 spec houses or models that weren't pre-sold. So then they, once those houses were completed and they couldn't sell them on the market and they went back in foreclosure, I really had no recourse on what I could do. I could file a mechanics lien. However, to file a mechanics lien and perfect it is very expensive, and most mortgage companies have priority, or finance companies have priority over my mechanics lien. It's a timing thing, and if it goes into foreclosure and the bank takes it back, my mechanics lien is wiped off. The slate is clear. They have free title or clear title to that piece of property and can sell it for whatever they can get.
Mr. Chairman, maybe Mr. Fuller can answer this, but are there, under the current prompt payment statute, are there some kind of requirements that if they're not met, waive the prompt payment? For instance, whether lien waivers are required, or what currently, under current law, would allow a contractor to not make the prompt payment if there was some kind of paperwork that wasn't in order?
Were you releasing some lien waivers even before you get paid
no.
to accommodate the contractor? No.
Mr. Chair, no.
I think that's been done, but not in your situation.
Did you have a response to that yet?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I have had, and this is an extreme case, I have had general contractors turn in lien waivers on my behalf that were fraudulent, but I don't, until I get cash in hand, I don't sign a lien waiver.
So I'm trying to think of how we're going to figure this out. I mean, how you get the notice that they got paid, or, you know, the they release the funds to the...
Well, Mr. Chairman.
A draw. I mean, you could call them up, and they're probably going to say, no, I didn't get any money.
Mr. Chairman, we're working on other legislation. Well,
that's what you were talking about earlier.
Yep, that when a contractor goes to a lending agency and says, I'm going to build a spec house, that he has to disclose a list of that there's going to be an excavator, there's going to be a landscaper, there's going to be a sheetrocker, a painter. He has to disclose not necessarily who he's using, but what subcontractors he's using to complete this house. And then as the project goes on, the bank...
Are we doing... it seems like we're doing half the work here if we do this and we're waiting for some other language. That's my personal...
Mr. Chairman? Okay.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman, I understand that there is more that needs to happen, but this is a pretty simple approach just to give them the same protection that somebody in a non-residential setting has already. And I have not heard from anybody in those settings. In a commercial setting, you know, I suppose it's happening there too, given the economy. But this, there is some teeth in the language of this paragraph in subdivision 3, and they would just like to be able to have access to that.
Mr. Fuller, did you have a reaction to?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bach, I mean, just looking at the bill, the language here, I look at page 1. Line 9, I assume that's what you're referring to, because they just have to show that they receive the services. So in the context of the subdivision, issues of whether those services were satisfactorily performed and other things of that nature don't seem to be addressed. So I assume there's nothing in here that says you can't waive it. When you go before court, there's equitable defenses and things like that. But the statute itself seems to say that if you provide those services, nothing else within the context of the subdivision could interfere with your right to get that payment. It seems rather absolute. You know, when they actually entered into court, I find it difficult to think that a court would order, you know, if you're told to paint it blue and you painted it green, would order payment. But strict terms of the statute seems rather absolute.
Mr. Chairman?
Letter Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, on line 9, it does say undisputed services. Right. Doesn't that cover? Isn't that Mr. Fuller is saying that that doesn't cover it, I guess?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, I think it would be arguable. I mean, the services were undisputed in the sense of that's what you were told to do, but is there some ability to say they weren't of the quality or something like that? So if you're reading into that, that the services totally comply with the contractual terms, that's not unreasonable. I just don't know if that's what it means. I'm saying it's arguable.
Mr. Doolittle would like to say something, if he might.
Mr. Chairman, my understanding is because this isn't saying that you have to be paid when it's only saying you have to be paid when there's undisputed services that a third party paid the contractor for already. So it's not saying that you just have to be paid 30 days after your invoice. It's only if you've been paid for undisputed services by a third party, then that contractor has to hold that money in trust for the people who did the work and pass that down. So if there's a dispute, then it has that you don't have to pay.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Doolittle, then how are retainages held then under this? Is there some provision for retainages are permissible or what?
There retainages don't even apply to this.
Doolittle or
Doolittle? I mean, usually in residential construction, it's on an invoice. It's not they don't usually take a retainage.
Well,
they're back.
Mr. Chairman, maybe that's why it's not on residential, because, I mean, normally on commercial construction, I know there always is a retainage issue where until the project is all, in order to make sure a contractor comes back and finishes up whatever the punch list is, they always hold something. So I'm just curious if, I mean, I think that potentially is an issue if you, the excavating company, for example, if you pay them off after they've dug the foundation, how do you get them to come back and backfill the building? Or is that invoiced separately?
Chairman,
yeah, do you have an answer, right? Senator Box going down the right track here, I think.
Okay. And
there's any holdback money?
It's an invoicing. The way I do my billing and my excavating is I will dig it, backfill it, and sewer and water, and we'll send out a bill after all of that is complete.
And so, Mr.
What if something's kind of disputed then at the little later, and the contractor wants to come back, and you got your dough and say goodbye?
Senator Metzen, I I understand what you're saying. I have to warranty my work.
Oh, so you're probably
I'm liable for if the sewer plugs or the water quits running. I mean, I have to warranty my work.
So you're licensed and bonded and everything else.
Yes, right. And I am licensed.
Maybe that would catch up to the question. I don't know.
I'm licensed and insured, so.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, in subsequent legislation that I'll have, there will be language having regarding retainages and residential. This, although, I mean, there's nothing in here that talks about even retainages in commercial. So, I mean, I just think it's making it consistent and gives them, as I said, it gives a little teeth to, or gives substantial teeth, actually, to getting that payment.
Mr. Chairman?
Back.
I'm curious, Senator Scheid, do you know, or maybe Mr. Fuller knows, why residential, at some point, the legislative body intentionally excluded residential construction? I'm wondering what the rationale was at that time.
And Mr. Anybody Chairman, know? This was the chairman's bill, I think in 1997, and I mean, I don't expect the chairman to tell you the reasoning. I think
hard to tell you what happened last week. I mean, 97, but go ahead. Okay, who knows about the 1997?
Remembers what you were doing.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name's Remy Stone. I actually have Bill Straczynski back here, too, so he and I were working this issue on opposite ends at that time.
1947
it was. Very quickly, the reason why this happened, this was part of a larger piece of legislation that involved progress payments that had the retainage piece that you're talking about, had the waivers piece in it, had a variety of other pieces relating to construction contracts, and that's the embodiment of 337 in totality. At that time, in the and I was representing the Builders Association of Minnesota at the time. At that time, we had a very healthy market going on, and as Ms. Jewison indicated, we could always see another project coming through the pipeline, and we were very concerned about the progress payment piece because that would have required 100% financing going into a project because it requires payment every 30 days plus the retainage. And so in this very room, in fact, working with Senator Metzen, we amended 337 to have the exception for small residential in both the prompt payment and progress payment pieces of that legislation.
And it was good stuff, wasn't it?
Yeah. It was a fight, but yeah. I hope that helped answer the question.
Am I the only one that, Senator Scheid, will do what the committee wants to do, but I'm just thinking that to do this right, we should probably put the pieces together and maybe not move this out today.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if you want to wait.
I fully agree what you're trying to get at here, and I'm going to support you, but I just think it should be a package deal, but it's up to the committee. Senator Bonham.
Mr. President, thank you. Senator Scheid, I do support what you're trying to do, too. I have met with subcontractors and understand the importance of this, but I'm curious about the 10-day issue. Is that industry standard? I know in other industries you want 30 days, then in slow times you want, you know, an extension, 60. Why is it 10 days in this industry?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I think that we actually require it, and I don't see where it says the days, but...
Line one, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman, for other kinds of contracts, anything doing with a state agency contracts, university contracts, local government contracts.
Hey, Mr.
Commercial.
I'll get a sergeant in here.
I thought what I said
that?
The
Rosa
magic word. And commercial contracts and large multi-unit residential all have that 10-day prompt payment requirement. Mr. Chairman, I understand this, Ms. Stone, tell me, this really takes care of about 70% of the issue for subcontractors, and particularly small subcontractors who need to get as much work as they can, but they need to get paid for it. So.
I don't think, I really support what you're trying to do. I just...
So,
especially this day and age when everybody's, a lot of people are going under. Senator.
Mr. Chairman, I think we should actually pass this bill without the other parts you're talking about, just because it seems to me that the reason it's happening is because they can do it. And if they couldn't do it, it might make the issue a little bit different. So to retain it, stuff could happen later on.
Okay, we'll keep talking. Senator Gimsey, did you have a...
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a couple of questions. The first one would be pertaining to the lien waiver portion and the testimony that we heard about when the mortgage company forecloses on it, that the lien waiver, the liens that subcontractors may have on that piece of property just go away. Could you clarify that for me? I don't understand that that's the case, that... and would like maybe we have an expert that could clarify that for us. But subcontractors have that right of to file lien waivers, and you can't close on a piece of property, you can't finish the sale until those are all satisfied. And I'm just a little curious about that.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might, before Mr. Jefferson responds to that, it's not really part of the bill here, but it is a statement she made, you know, concerning that, if you want to have her clarify that, her real world experience here.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Gimson, I can file a mechanics lien within 120 days of the last day I performed work on a piece of property. I have 1 year to perfect that lien. And what that means is I have to file a lien, the paperwork is very difficult to do, so I generally hire an attorney to do it. Then within that 1 year, I have to start the legal process of foreclosing this lien if the bank or the finance company has priority, which means they filed paperwork with the county prior to me doing any work. Then if it goes into foreclosure, they have priority and get their money first. Whether they make money or lose money, they do not pass any profits or anything down the line to cover these mechanics liens, unless I fully perfect the lien and buy the piece of property myself from the bank.
Well, thank you for that explanation. I guess I've never seen where it's gone to that extent. That must be a rare circumstance where it gets to be that point.
I had it happen 56 times last year where the bank had priority over me on my mechanics team.
Well, don't get me wrong. I appreciate what you're attempting to do. You know, subcontractors need to be paid. The other aspect of this that I wonder about is lending institutions require us as contractors to do a sworn construction statement before we start a project, when we go in for the money. To apply for the money to get the loan. And every time we take a draw, we have to list the contractors and what the payments will be as we go through the process to receive a progress payment. Before we can do a second draw, we have to have all of the lien waivers in hand as we go in to get the second draw. So I kind of wonder how we get into such trouble when our lending institutions have this mechanism already in place, and you know, I'm a little concerned.
That.
Are we dealing with something, a bigger issue of fraud?
I can answer that, and yes, because some of the general contractors that I used to do work for had their own construction loan companies, their own title companies, and their own closing companies. So when it came time to take a draw or to close a piece of property, they could bond around us or go around us and get the property closed and into someone else's hands before we had a chance to, you know about it.
Mr. Straczynski Senator, would like to say something.
Senator Bach first. Maybe Mr. Fuller or Mr. Straczynski might be able to answer this. Are there other provisions in Section 337 where residential is exempt that we don't see on this page, or is it just the prompt payment part? I'm just wondering if we're looking at one little piece of 337, or are there residential exemptions in other places in 337, and we're just looking at one piece of it?
Chairman,
do you know that,
Senator Bach, I don't know the specific answer about the retainage part of it. I have a lot of background in this particular provision, though.
Mr. Chairman, I think that there is that they're exempt in the progress payment.
Yes, we
so
are.
The same language that is being stricken in this bill appears in current law, but we're not striking that. We're dealing just with the prompt payment piece rather than the progress payment.
Okay, what's the...
Mr. Chairman? If I might, I'd just like to... I'm Bill Straczynski, and I represent the Minnesota Electrical Association, association of about 800 rural electrical contractors, as well as the Sheet Metal Air Conditioned Roofing Contractors Association. And I was involved on behalf of the subcontractors in 1997, coming up with the original statute. And we made lots of changes that dealt with lien waivers and some of those things. And the statute, basically, it was a negotiated deal at the time in residential construction. Remy Stone was successful in getting the amendment adopted, which excluded prompt payment to residential construction, smaller units, because their financing mechanism is different. It's become an increasingly a problem over the last several years, and so that's what this bill simply does. It takes all the remedies available to you as a commercial contractor, and anybody building larger than 13 units, you now have to follow the law on prompt payment. It says when you get paid, you have to pay your subcontractors within 10 days. It's just that simple, and this is now applying that same section of law to residential contractors, so that as they get paid, not before, but when they get paid, they've got 10 days to pay their subcontractor. If not, the penalties go into force where you can take them to court, get interest and attorney's fees. So this is really just a level playing field issue, if you will, and this is a correction that's been needed to be done since 1997. So we support this legislation. And it does take care of about 70, or I'd say even a little bit more, percent of the problems that exist out there today. It's contractors get paid, they're not paying the subs. Now they have to. They would have to under this law.
Okay, what's the pleasure?
Thank you.
I guess,
Mr. Chairman,
I'm comfortable if you want to move it out and then add some of the other provisions or thoughts in the next couple of weeks or something, if that's your desire.
Mr. Chairman, I'd appreciate that. And the one thing we could do is that I think my bill, the other bill is in the committee, or has it been referred?
Brian, do you know?
Do we have it in yet? Yeah, referred. Yes. It was introduced today, Mr. Chairman. So, and I'm sure it came here.
Went to you.
It came to the Commerce.
We can bring it here.
It should.
Okay, well,
I don't know who should give it. It should be consistent anyway.
It would come here. And, you know, we can hold on that, you know, before we go to the floor, if that's what the committee would like. But I'd like to move this and show that the legislature thinks we should move in this direction.
With the understanding, we're going to hear the other one soon. I'm comfortable moving this out, I guess. I believe people should get paid, too, in a prompt fashion.
And Mr. Chairman, and have some recourse if they're not.
Yeah.
Well,
Senator Bach,
Chairman, the only I mean, but it comes back to, I mean, the general contractor might have discovered something that ultimately they would be liable for as the prime that they maybe didn't know when they contracted with the individual. I don't know. I mean,
would that be the whole
back? We're just looking at one page here, and we're not looking at the rest of 337, so I'm wondering what else is in there.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Senator Latz?
I don't know if this helps clarify at all, but the prompt payment provision, at least on line 1.9 in existing statute, only applies to payment for undisputed services. So I suppose if there's a dispute as to the quality or otherwise of the services, then this prompt payment provision would not apply. At least that's the way I'm reading it. Mr. Fuller might be able to. I'm new to this section of law, but maybe Mr. Fuller knows more. I don't know if this helps Senator Bach's question or not.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, if I am in fact paid for the work and there becomes an issue, that's what my insurance and my bonding would take care of. So if they had to hire someone else to come back in and fix the problem, my insurance covers that.
Are there any contractors or people on the other side of this issue in the audience that would like to be heard? Senator Gimsey, did you have one last statement?
Well, just a point of curiosity again, Mr. Chairman. The contractor, in order to get you to come back, and I am a contractor, I understand that at times it's difficult once you've paid a sub sometimes to get them to return to take care of some of the issues that you might have further down the road. In order to get to access your insurance, though, what is the procedure for the contractor?
Senator Gipsy, before I go to work for a general contractor, they require me to give them a certificate of insurance, which lists my insurance company, what my limits are, and what my general liability. So they know that I'm insured and would know who my company is and my agent.
Senator Gimsey.
Mr. Chairman, thanks. Would that require, though, that would require the contractor to either sue you or some other legal step on the part of the contractor in order to establish that the fault was yours, say, for a sewer line that continually gets plugged up as a sag in it and doesn't work or something like that, in order to get you to potentially come back?
Mr. Chairman, if we might, Mr. Straczynski can.
Mr. Chairman, I can shed a little light on that. The process is pretty simple. You, Mr. Chairman, as an owner, can contract with Senator Gimsey to build a house for you. As I, a subcontractor, whether it's plumbing, excavation work, painting, or whatever, submit my invoices to you. You submit them to, then Senator Gimsey would submit them to you, the owner of the property. You then pay the senator or pay the general contractor. Whether I painted the house or whatever, that contractor has been paid for your work, bad or good, but they've been paid for it. And all this bill does is say, if you've been paid for it, then you have to, and you wouldn't submit it to the person for payment if it was faulty. You wouldn't submit it to the owner or the bank. I'm saying, so it's just a real simple chain. You as the owner paid the general contractor. This bill says now you got to pay the subcontractor. Disputes are handled another way through insurance, litigation, whatever. Typically, it's not a dispute when you submit the bill for payment, when the contractor submits it to the bank or you as the owner. You're paying the bill. You would like to know as the owner, frankly, that the subcontractor has been paid, so no liens are going to get filed later on. So it's just simple chain of payment. Follow the cash.
And Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, what Mr. Straczynski is saying, I want to make sure that I understand, is that we aren't changing anything about what you do if there's faulty work.
Correct.
That system stays in play. I mean, you'd have to, you know, I suppose you might call them and tell them there's a problem. Maybe they take care of it. Maybe they say, wasn't my fault. Now you pursue breach of contract or, you know, look for some remedy that way. This doesn't change that. It just says that when they've done the work and it's not disputed, they should be paid promptly. So.
Okay, members, Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni.
Chairman, Mr. Jasinski, don't go away. Because, you know, I think the bill should be passed, but I still don't think we've heard why it was the only thing I heard was these things are financed differently, and so we put it in statute in 1997. Is there a real reason for why it was put in statute?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, it's part of the Senator Tomasoni, excellent question, but you know how this process works. It was a multi-page piece of legislation at the time, and we had lots of actors involved in it, and this bought peace in the valley at that particular time, and that's the only reason it was done, is to remove opposition to the bill at the time it was passed. You heard from home builders today on it, so the times have changed. So that was just part of a compromise on the legislation initially. But it has become an issue, more of an issue now, because residential contractors have a different standard than commercial contractors, and it's becoming more problematic. This remedies that situation that we can document. It's become more problematic.
So, Mr. Jasinski, did you and Ms. Stone come 180 degrees on this? Is it that?
Madam Chair, I was trying to get this done in 1997. Remy Stone was my opposition at the time.
It was her fault.
All right, Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move that Senate File 638 be recommended to pass. And it will go to Judiciary. Because it apparently, I spoke to Senator Moore about that, they want it because counsel pointed out that it changes the contract. So for the contract between the contractors and the subcontractors.
All right, on the motion. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed. Motion prevails.
Chairman, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Think twice before someone asks you to carry a bill that just strikes existing language. No, I appreciate work.
Oh, the people leave.
Just do that stuff or you try to do it right, but.
I'll put it in my pocket and bring it back. Thanks.
There's probably a reason.
Yes,
a whole lot of it.
So what about paint?
This is a... For the airline, I don't think they are.
You know, paintball?
There's a general.
What are we going to do about that?
All right, good. Thanks.
Who's the general if you're the...
Okay.
Yes.
You're the person paying.
We're going to have Senator Dahl and your witnesses can.
Can you be the owner and the general?
Get seated and.
I'm sorry, I put you to sleep.
You woke us up. Record
of being sent. Well, have you had any trouble with your the dates? Your appointments?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right. Good afternoon, Senator Dahl and your witnesses. Commissioner, how are you today?
Doing well.
Good to see you. Senator Dahl, it's always good to see you, of course.
Well, thank you. It's good to see you, too. If I might take a moment.
Senator, File 477, Senator Dahl.
Personal privilege. On the last bill, I guess I wanted to throw my support as well, being a subcontractor. It's a very good idea.
Oh,
well, we change our mind.
Very good idea.
If you got a good thing going, we might
be
the sale.
If the bill was in place or legislated passed, I would never have to have used it because I've always been paid on time. But I know some folks that's not been the case. Anyway, I appreciate the opportunity here today, Mr. Chair and members. We did hear this bill last year, and it's back again this year. We'll make it all the way through. Senate File 477 is a... What it does is establishes a pilot program for recycling post-consumer paint here in Minnesota. And it'll be – what we do right now is we implement that system through our counties and our solid waste programs. And this program will be implemented by the manufacturers. They're going to come together through a third-party organization to collect paint, do the transporting, do the recycling. Well, they'll use the existing infrastructure, but they will be in charge of the implementation and the funding of the system. It's a unique program that will be a model for the nation once it's we go through this pilot program. The program is really it's a product stewardship model where we, instead of having the taxpayers pay for this and to provide that service, we'll have the private industry integrate that into the cost of the product that's being used so that at the end of its life cycle, now it can be either recycled, reused, or disposed of in an environmentally appropriate manner. And, again, integrating those costs into the product itself. The reason why it's before the legislature as well is because to implement a program like this, manufacturers need to coordinate, cooperate to a certain degree. And some of the information they need to share rubs up against some antitrust laws. And so we need to have state oversight and on this and some authorized conduct put into statute so that to the extent that it's necessary for providing this particular program, they can go forward and not be at risk of lawsuit. So I have several testifiers here today from manufacturers, from the counties, from the Contractors Association, as well as the retailers. I'd prefer to go through the bill real quickly before I have them testify.
That's fine.
Okay. Yeah. Section 1 on this bill, Mr. Chair, really is just referring to the rules governing the handling of any trade secrets and sales information that the commissioner or the PCA might get because they'd be overseeing this. Subdivision 2, I know we don't normally put in a purpose statement in our bills, but really to do the authorized conduct and the antitrust measures, it's important to have the purpose statement in place that establishes the framework for the parameters of the regarding the antitrust exceptions. Subdivision 2 just defines the entities and the items and the original concepts that are within the bill. And Subdivision 3 goes into the actual pilot program itself. This program would begin on September 1st, 2009, and would run through June 30th, 2012. A third-party organization representing the paint manufacturers would develop and implement this program. It is only for post-consumer paint. What that is our architectural paint. So it's not for paint that's used in paintballs, for instance, or painting cars or anything like that. It's just for usually what you'd use in your home, right, and or in buildings, painting on walls, things of that nature. The program would include strategies to reduce the generation of post-consumer paint. It would also promote the reuse and recycling of the paint. It would undertake a responsibility for negotiating and executing the agreements for the collection, the transport, and the processing of the paint. The cost of the program must be determined, and a cost recovery fund mechanism must be implemented and integrated into the purchase price of a container of paint. It's an assessment that would be equitable and sustainable and must not exceed the costs of the program. And it's our intention to let the marketplace really dictate the level of what that assessment should be. However, the commissioner or the PCA has approval authority over that assessment. The Minnesota manufacturers and retailers that have been involved with this process, they want their product to remain at price competitive with surrounding states, so that, they're going to put this at a level that makes sense, where they can, they'll sell their product at a competitive price, but still cover their costs. I believe that last year we were estimating that this may run in the area of 20 to 30 cents per container. In addition, the program would include an educational component to allow consumers to know about the program itself and that there was an assessment for the operation of the program. Section 3 is what is the authorized conduct that really just authorized manufacturers may engage in what could be considered anti-competitive conduct, but only to the degree that's necessary to plan and implement the pilot program. And then Section 4 is about some reporting that we will do. Manufacturers through their representative organization will prepare and deliver a report to the commissioner of the PCA by October 15th of 2010. At a minimum, the report would include a description of all the methods used to collect, transport, and process the paint in all the regions of Minnesota, the volume of paint that's collected, volume of the paint collected, and by the method. whether it was reused, recycled, or processed in some other way. The total cost for implementing the program will be determined by an independent financial audit that would be funded through this this assessment. An evaluation of the operation of the program's funding mechanism, whether it's working as intended or needs to be modified, and then also what kind of educational materials or notifications were used to be provided to the consumers, and how was it disseminated. And then we would have an analysis of the environmental costs and benefits of collecting and recycling the paint. And then finally, this particular, there would be one more report that would go to the legislature by January 15th, 2011. And this whole section of statute would expire on June 30th, 2012, at which point we would even know that whether we're going forward with this program as is or if it's been modified, and the intention that this would be looked at around the nation as to how other states would model their own paint recycling programs. With that said, I can turn it over to County Commissioner Victoria Reinhart.
Mr. Chair. Senator Michelle.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And just for the author before you get into some testimony, Senator Dahl, help me with my memory here, but has the language of this bill changed substantially since last year's bill was vetoed? Do you have kind of peace in the valley on this, or am I thinking of a different bill?
No, you're thinking, Mr. Chair, Senator Michelle, thinking of the same bill, and yes, it has changed. One of the things I think was the sticking point is for consumer protection, we thought it was necessary to put a cap on how much the assessment could be. We've removed that. And so just going to let the marketplace decide. The members of this association then can determine what would be the actual cost. They can determine how much to integrate into their the cost of the container of paint to help pay for it. And it's my understanding that the governor's office is agreeable with the language that we now have before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee. I'm Victoria Reinhart. I am a Ramsey County Commissioner, and I am here today representing the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board, the Association of Minnesota Counties, and obviously Ramsey County as well. The paint bill really represents a crucial policy and economic opportunity for counties. It's a culmination of 7 years of work. This has been a national dialogue with the retailers and contractors and paint manufacturers. Anybody that really has anything to do with the waste paint system or paint in general and nationally have been trying to work this out because, quite frankly, especially from the manufacturer's standpoint, they could see the writing on the wall that there was likely to be legislation that would mandate certain things. They didn't want it to be piecemeal. They wanted to do something that they could work through and have something that was consistent across the United States. And so they chose Minnesota as the demonstration state primarily because of the infrastructure we have in place. The household hazardous waste programs in Minnesota do collect or generally will collect or allow for paint to come into their system, and it is then either recycled or reused or properly disposed of, depending on what the condition of the paint is. It is estimated that 10%, the EPA estimates that 10% of all paint that is sold becomes waste paint. In Minnesota, that's 1.3 million gallons per year. Right now, the counties in Minnesota are mandated to collect and deal with the waste, and it is costing approximately $4 million per year. And that's county property taxpayers that are covering that cost. With product stewardship that Senator Dahl mentioned as the kind of the framework that we're working with here, it really is that those who make, sell, and use a product are responsible for all aspects of the product, including the waste. So it causes a feedback loop, especially for the producers and the consumers. The paint industry really has stepped forward, and they want to take responsibility for this and really want to avoid, as I said, they want to avoid a government mandate, but trying to make something that really will work. We have a couple of models in place. The e-waste legislation in Minnesota is a good model, and also in Canada they have product stewardship models in place for paint. This is obviously a different product and a different industry, but it is something that, as all the stakeholders came together, said this is the way they felt that they could deal with it. This is not a tax. That was one of the issues that came up last year, was is this double taxation? And it is truly not a tax. There isn't money that's coming, that's being paid by the consumer, and then is transmitted to government. This is through the third-party organization. It has oversight of government so that they cannot, I mean, it's written into state law that they cannot collect more than what the cost is, but there's also the oversight of the state agency that has to go through this and make sure that they are getting the proper reporting and that there isn't, this isn't a money maker for the paint manufacturers. It's trying to deal with the costs that are already being borne, in this case, however, by county government, and trying to cover some of those costs. During the time frame of the pilot project, clearly our budgets are set. During the period of that of the pilot project, the counties could choose to lower the taxes at that point, but they could also look at trying to make this a permanent project. They can. Right now, we are spending approximately, as I said, $4 million just on paint. We are spending counties in Minnesota on waste products. We are spending about $55.9 million. The state right now, and these are for mandated services, the state right now pays the counties or reimburses the counties for $14 million of that. So clearly, $4 million is not a huge amount of money, but it's huge for us right now because of all of the other mandates and all of the other hits that we're all working on. And I know that you're very well aware of the situation, what's going to happen to county government. So having that $4 million that we don't have to spend on paint and that can help us pick up some of the costs of the other mandated products, and or in the long run, once this hopefully becomes a permanent project or a permanent program, not only in Minnesota but across the country, we will be able to lower the taxes because we don't have to pay for that anymore. So, again, it's, I guess, just one other thing I'd like to touch on, and that is the antitrust language. And this has taken a lot for me. I'm not an attorney, so trying to figure out how this all works. But basically, my understanding is that the federal government, the state cannot exempt companies from federal antitrust. However, they acknowledge and recognize the state exemption of federal antitrust if there are certain components, and I don't know what all of those are, except that I do know that one of the components is the purpose statement. Another component is the state oversight, which we put into the bill this year. And so the reason that this may look a little bit different from the antitrust standpoint is the fact that they're simply trying to meet the requirements that are set up by the federal government in order for the state to allow the antitrust activity to go forward. And again, it is very limited to just during this pilot program. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Who's there?
Mr. Chair, this is Mr. Weber from Hirschfields. He's the chief operating officer.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. My name is Mike Weber. I am the chief operating officer of Hirschfields. Hirschfields is a Minnesota family-owned business. We'll be celebrating business in Minnesota for 115 years next year. We do operate a paint manufacturing plant here in Minnesota in addition to 30 retail outlets. This legislation will enable the paint manufacturing industry to develop and implement a post-consumer paint management system for collection, reuse, and recycling. As you're aware, local Minnesota government entities, along with paint manufacturers and retailers, and this does include the Retail Association with Buzz Anderson and also the Hardware Association represented by Mark Harden. We have been working on this for the last couple of years in various committee meetings.
They're all on board? Is that what you're saying?
They have been part of that process and on board, yes, sir.
Okay, continue on.
While the ultimate goal of the dialogue is a nationally coordinated system, the industry needed one state to be the pilot for this program. The industry would like to see, obviously, Minnesota be the model because of its highly developed collection infrastructure that's currently in place, and also its strong commitment to environmental standards. The assessment will be used to fund paint collection, reuse, and recycling and disposal activities, not only in the areas being serviced, but in additional underserviced areas. Consumers will have more places to take leftover paint, i.e., we plan if the collection, if the map allows it, to be collecting at some, many of our Hirschfeld stores. And it will no longer be constrained by city and county lines, and contractors will have an opportunity to drop off leftover paint for recycling and proper disposal without paying a fee. Currently, if a contractor wants to drop off some paint, they need to go to one of the collection sites and actually pay a fee. Finally, the assessment will go toward the consumer education outreach for the program, as well as for record-keeping and reporting requirements. The bill specifies that the assessment cannot exceed the cost of the program, which we think is key. The program, as proposed in this legislation, has worked well in Canada for over a decade and widely accepted by paint manufacturers, paint retailers, government agencies, environmental groups, and consumers in that country. We believe that paint companies are in a better position than government to determine and manage paint as for its reuse and recycling. We also believe that paint companies are in a better position than government to teach consumers the value of purchasing paint responsibly, as well as the value of proper storage and reuse. We also believe that privatization collection, recycling, and disposal of paint industry has an incentive to work toward consistently improving efficiencies in the system, leading hopefully to lower costs of the program. Thus, Hirschfeld supports Senate File 477 and the implementation of the Paint Pilot Stewardship Program, and we look forward to working with our retail and customer partners, the state of Minnesota, Minnesota local government agencies, the hazardous waste programs, and to implement this program and to see if it could be successful in our state. Thank you.
Senator, has the PCA been involved in your work and discussion?
Sure, yes, they have.
And I see it's there's a little more work that they're going to have to do with this bill. And do they need any more people, or have they said anything about that?
Mr. Chair, there isn't any more work necessarily on the bill. What they'll be doing is just looking at what the third-party organization comes up with for their plan and for the assessments, give their approval to move forward. I think everything pretty much everything else is in place and ready to go. This particular language has been vetted by all the interested parties over the last last year to make sure that it's everything everybody wants.
Usually, if we give a department a little more work, they say, "Well, give us seven more people."
Sometimes
some of us think that they could do it with the people they have on hand.
Exactly, Mr. Chair. Because this is the Business, Industry, and Jobs Committee, I do have representation from the Contractors Association to speak on this quickly, and also
up to the committee. It seems to me you've done your homework quite well here. You've got everybody on board, and the only thing that troubles me, not troubles me too much, but assessments or fees or whatever, somebody's paying a little bit. So
certainly, and if I may,
I just want to make that clear that we're
Mr.
not.
Mr. Chair, if I may clarify something to Senator Michelle's question earlier, and I've been slightly corrected. It was my understanding that the governor's office had maybe approved this language. They haven't approved the actual language, that they have not been given an opposition to it, and that the issues that were at issue last year have been addressed in the bill. So the indication is that they're looking favorably at it. But I don't
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dahl, well, that was part of my question. The other part of my question is if there is basically no cap on this, I was wondering, okay, now how would the governor be endorsing this bill if there was no cap? There has to be some structure to that. And you talk about members of the committee that will be setting the cost of this fee onto the paint. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Senator Rosen, the way this will work is the third-party organization, in conjunction with the manufacturers, will look at the overall system to implement this and determine what are the costs going to be. And right now they have to determine costs and how, you know, where they buy their supplies from, how much the labeling is going to be, what's the transport cost to get it from manufacturing to the store, all part of cost of doing business. And now they're going to integrate this part, this element, into the cost of it as well. How do we dispose of or recycle this as well so that the taxpayer isn't paying for it through county taxes, but is being integrated into the cost of that product? And so what that final assessment or that fee or whatever that cost is, when it's not determined as of yet. But once it is, then it'll come to the commissioner, the PCA, for review and approval.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one more question? Thank you. Senator Dahl. And then could you just go through one more time how that's going to work out in the other greater Minnesota local units of government, state and local units, other counties? Do they all have the same collection policy and how they dispose of paint? And is there going to be any discrepancies as far as distance and, you know, handling of the paint?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rosen. The household hazardous waste system in Minnesota is pretty mature. However, the manufacturers, the paint manufacturers, also recognize that there are going to need to be more collection sites. It's not enough. It's more than most states have at this point. The way each center is run could be slightly different, but the fact that they have to deal with the paint either through reuse or recycling or proper disposal, that is, I believe, very consistent across the state. It may be, you know, a different application depending on where you're at or what's close by as far as the market. We do have in Minnesota also the Amazon Recycling, which is John Sagala is here. The contractors are here as well. But so we have a market in Minnesota where some of the other states don't have that. So in answer to your question, it will be consistent. There may be some additional infrastructure, and the idea here is that the third-party organization would take over those costs, that portion that is dealing with paint, through the household hazardous waste facilities. Does that answer your question?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Reinhart, well, yes, it does, but it also poses another question as far as then if it's going to be handled differently, could there be a different fee for paint handling outside of the metro area where you have quantity, mass? No?
Mr. Chair, I'll handle that. And Senator Rosen, it's got to be a uniform fee. That's one of the reasons for bringing together the authorized conduct in this language, because it has to be uniform across the board. And this is just a pilot project, so we're requiring that, you know, all the parties work together on this. There can't be one that says, well, we decided we don't want to do it at this time, because we need to be able to assess that it is working or it isn't working, and it's going to require that all come together. There was a question about whether border cities might, you know, there might be some issue where you'd go across the border because it was 20 cents cheaper to buy a gallon of paint there, but I think, again, the manufacturers want to sell their paint, and there's not going to be a fee on this that would offset the cost of a gallon of gas to go someplace else. The other part of this is the convenience factor for everyone. It's right now you're bound by county lines, and so now you can go anywhere in the state and drop off your paint. Contractors don't have to go to a special site. They'll be able to just – they won't have a special fee to pay. We envision then, like Hirschfields will be doing with their stores, that the big box retailers also may have collection points, so that you wouldn't have to necessarily do this just at county sites, that you'll have it more places to actually bring your paint. And again, this is a pilot project. There may be some tweaks that we need to make, some things we haven't necessarily thought all the way through, but I think a lot of smart people have been thinking about this for a while. I think we tried to cover most of the bases here, and if something comes up, that's why we'll do the reporting and be able to address that during this time period.
Senator Scoy, did
you have a... Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dahl, just a couple of comments, just three comments. First was, we heard a report on the pesticide collection. And I think as you set this up, you should pay attention to, as Senator Rosen was talking about, these smaller sites that are far apart that don't collect a lot in any given time period, and give them the flexibility to probably not be required to bring it in every year, because sometimes the amounts are so small it doesn't make any sense to do that. The other thing is you probably should pay a little attention, because we heard part of the report was there was a semi-truck of chemical that showed up at one of these collection sites, and they were required to take it. And, I think it came from out of state. So you might want to think about that and how you're going to deal if somebody shows up with a huge volume of paint that has been kind of collected at or even sitting somewhere. And then the third one deals with what you just talked about, the border issue. It's an issue. I mean, the paint stores in Fargo are going to have an easier time of it than the paint stores in Moorhead. There's no way around that, because they're not going to have to pay the 30 cents, and they're probably not going to have to collect the paint. And anybody who was around during the pop bottle debate when we were making people collect pop bottles knows that retailers don't like to have that stuff hanging around their store where they're trying to sell new stuff. So, you know, these are things that, you know, you're going to have to kind of work through. And you know, as somebody who represents, the west part of the state in my Senate district, it is a real issue that we deal with on a lot of competitive bases. And I don't know exactly how all it's going to work out. But, when you're putting this pilot project together, those certainly would be three areas of concern.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scoy, a couple points. One on the semi issue with bringing in other paint. I right now, as Commissioner Reinhart mentioned, we have Amazon Environmental is really the only collection point in the upper Midwest for paint right now. So there's a lot of that coming in, and usually they're going to be contracted to go from the other states. They're already being sent to Minnesota. I think that they would bypass a stop there. They already know that they've got another stop that they can make to legally unload their paint. As far as the issue of the price, we're going to leave it up to the paint manufacturers and those retailers in the area to try to figure out what's a good optimum level there, so that we're not seeing a unfair advantage. They've all bought into this program at this point. They're the ones that come forward with the program, and it is a pilot. So after the pilot is over, there is my understanding that if retailers don't want to pass on the cost part of it, once the pilot program is over, they can opt out as far as extending that additional price forward if they feel they need that to balance things out.
Okay, further discussion. Senator Gerlach.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Dahl, Subdivision 1, or Section 2, Subdivision 1 is the purpose. There's a couple of sentences there. Maybe it's one long sentence about the purpose. Generally, and maybe I'm speaking for most folks, and that is that we've shied away from putting purpose or findings or whatever it is, the paragraphs at the beginning of statute, because we generally let the words of the law stand on their own without putting that all of that in. And so my suggestion is that, get your comment on it, shouldn't we maybe delete the purpose section? And, you know, your bill should start off with definitions rather than putting the purpose in.
Mr. Chair,
I thought I heard earlier Commissioner Reinhart or the senator saying something about the antitrust, that they wanted to make this pretty
correct.
Mr.
Chair, and
usually
Senator
you're
Gerlach.
Right. 98.5% of the time we don't do that or do this, and we shouldn't be doing it. But
right.
I think that's the answer.
It's the legal counsel for the paint manufacturers determined based on the federal statutes and how we can have state action doctrines or whatever they might be to allow this type of activity to occur, that there needs to be some purpose statement or identification of what we're why we have this program in the first place, and that they can be used to justify the action. It defines what we're trying to do, and gives that those parameters for the authorized conduct, and that's why the purpose of the purpose statement. But probably end up doing, which goes to judicial next, and we'll Senator Betzel, I know, will have a whack at it or two, and I think we may tighten up some of this language as well through that process. But that's what we've been told from their legal counsel. that they need to get around the antitrust or to comply with that.
All right. I think we have a pretty good discussion, and there's a lot of people have been working long hours to come to a reasonable conclusion here. And as a pilot program, this is for the airlines, right? My humor is that, yeah, okay. But somebody wants to move this bill for the senator. Senator Carlson will do that, and to the Judiciary Committee, did you say?
Yes.
Okay. Further discussion? Anybody in the audience wish to be heard on this? Okay. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you, folks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, thank you very much.
Senator Olsen has been sitting here like a nice young man. Senate File 383, plastic yard waste bags, composting requirements. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, I have an A3 amendment that would put this in the form that I would prefer it to be in.
Senator Scoyle put the amendment on to get it in the form that.
Thank you,
Senator
Mr. Chair.
Olsen, on the motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Olsen.
Mr. Chair, the A3 amendment does a couple things. When we were in the Environmental Committee, there was some discussion with the City of Minneapolis that they are developing a cart system for their yard waste that, just like a trash cart, that people will put their yard waste in a cart and put it out by the curb, and they will collect it in a truck specifically for yard waste. So they had asked to be exempt from having this provision for a biodegradable bag because they're going to a different system. So that's in 125, 1.25, and 1.26. And then we did back up the enactment date from September of this year to January 1 of 2010. So that's kind of the main changes in the amendment.
Okay, that's fine. Now tell us what the bill does.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have a couple of testifiers, and I'll briefly first go over the bill. It basically would require in the metropolitan area that for yard waste going to recycling recovery facilities that it would be a biodegradable bag. Mm-hmm. And if it's appropriate, I do have some samples if I could pass those around. And and you can see that, number one, they're clearly marked as a compostable bag or biodegradable bag so that it will break down over time. And then we have there's one bucket of compost that has plastic in it from a composting site with plastic in it, and
smells?
It doesn't break down as the really good stuff I want to put in some of my plants I have down in my office, and that's using a recyclable bag that does biodegradably break down, and it turns into a real nice compost that can be used for commercial.
What are the bags made of, the ones you're promoting?
Well, that's why I have some expert testimony with me. And we'll start with Mr. Kockauer from Cortex, who manufactures these bags right here in Minnesota.
Morning. Afternoon.
Afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee. Thank you for having us here. My name is Cliff Kockauer with Cortex Corporation, and we're a manufacturer of industrial packaging as well as industrial chemicals. One of the areas that we've delved into is that of biodegradable and compostable plastics. What we're here to address today is getting some clarification on the types of materials that can be allowed to go to compost and be allowed to be used, because there's a variety of different technologies that can be used that are true compostable plastics. They will biodegrade in the right conditions, but there are other technologies that are being promoted which are additives to polyethylene, PET, and non-biodegradable plastics, which is creating some confusion in the marketplace. The compostable materials would be made up of, it could be petroleum-based, or it could be from renewable resources. Cargill NatureWorks is one of the larger manufacturers of this type of resin, developed from corn. It's a polylactic acid resin. And that material will actually break down based on some industry standards. There's three basic standards. I think the one in this bill is now ASTM D6400. But The main difference is this is intended to clarify the type of language that can be used on plastics that are degradable versus non-degradable.
That's why I passed that one off. Thank you. I also have Mr. Tilley today, and I don't know what...
He left town.
I have Commissioner Reinhardt here to step up to the plate on this bill also.
Commissioner, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Just so you know, my background is actually in the environmental field. I worked for the Office of Environmental Assistance, and so anything that is dealing with garbage, basically, they call upon me to talk about that. I'm not sure what that says about me. But I am here representing the Solid Waste Management Coordinating Board, and we have adopted a position in favor of this bill and having compostable biodegradable bags for yard waste. As you can see by the product as it's coming around, the reality is if it is a good composting yard waste is a good end product. And people, it's in high demand, quite frankly. But when you have the plastic in there, it basically becomes unusable. And so we wanted to make sure that we are able to use this resource. We certainly don't want, and I know yard waste hasn't been allowed in landfills for a very, very long time. But we want to make sure that we're getting the best use out of this. And so in most of the yard waste sites that are out there right now, if you bring a plastic bag in, you're required to empty your leaves out of that. But unfortunately, there's a lot of plastic that is ending up in these composting sites. So it is just try to get the highest value out of the product. It is a waste product, but it can turn into a nutrient for plants and the land, and it's something that we really believe fits very well with the master plan that we have and the vision that we have for dealing with the environment in the most proactive way possible.
Senator Olsen, does that September 1, 2009? That's pretty fast pace. Is that?
That's what, Mr. Chair. That's what the amendment changes from. It changes it to January 1st of 2010, and that was a concern.
I know you talked about Minneapolis. Oh, you did mention that.
Yep.
That just seems like kind of a fast pace.
That was a concern that was raised, so we have addressed that.
I get it. You moved it up a little bit. Yeah, Senator Letts.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Olsen or Commissioner, whomever could answer the question. If I'm just a regular guy sitting at home and I'm cleaning up my yard and I put it in a plastic bag out on the curb for my city's yard waste collection folks to pick up, how will this affect me?
You'll be spending time in Stillwater.
on tour with the Public Safety Committee, I hope.
Actually, if I can address that, this should actually clear it up and make it easier for you as a consumer by creating a structure that allows you to know which type of plastic to use and allows consumers to know that when they're buying a bag to put it in, that the actual compost facilities can take that bag. Right now, there are companies marketing bags that say degradable, which will take 5 years or maybe never biodegrade in that type of environment, and in that case, compost facilities then begin to reject using any type of plastic. This would create a certified logo, or basically language would be required, or penalties would be given to manufacturers or people selling products that don't meet that standard.
How many manufacturers do this? Is it just
it's a very growing industry. When we started doing it, we were the first.
So you don't have a monopoly on this.
No, we certainly don't. We are a very small player. Cargill NatureWorks manufactures about 85 million pounds a year of the resin. They distribute it to different plastic manufacturers. In Minnesota, there's three different companies extruding this, and I think we're the second as far as volume goes.
Mr. Chairman, follow up.
Follow up, Senator Letts.
So presumably then the St. Louis Park City Council would pass an ordinance amendment that would require that if I put something out for pickup by the yard waste collection, it would have to be in one of the approved bags, either a paper bag or one of these biodegradable certified plastic bags rather than just any other plastic bag off the shelf, which I could probably still use for my regular garbage, but I couldn't put it into the yard waste collection stream. Is that right? Is that how it would work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Letts, yes, that is how it would work, and I know that there are several cities right now that actually do have that type of ordinance in place. I believe Moorhead is actually one that has specified when you are putting out yard waste that it has to be in the bag that meets a certain specification for compostability. So it's something that's being done right now across Minnesota in many communities, but the idea here is to make sure that you do get something that doesn't just say compostable on it, but that it actually meets certain standards so that it will actually degrade.
So then, Mr. Chairman, I'd be responsible then for going out and finding a retail facility that would sell me a bag that's in compliance with the city's requirements for putting stuff in its collection stream. Is that right?
I guess so. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Letts, yes, and in some cases I believe that they actually have them for sale through the city or through the county where you can pick them up as well. So, yes.
Well, Senator Letts, why would, if this becomes law in the seven-county area, what would St. Louis Park have to say about it, if anything? Unless they wanted to opt out, like Minneapolis, they did KISS for a year or something. This would be law.
Correct.
And it wouldn't have anything to do with South St. Paul or St. Louis Park, would it?
Yeah.
This is a seven-county mandate.
Mr. Chair, and Senator Letts, that's true. I suspect they may just send out a notification to their residents that from X day forward, you know, you need to use the biodegradable bags. And
okay, so, Mr. Chairman, then this bill would mandate that the consumer that is filling a bag with yard waste that's destined for a
have to do this
for a compost to do this, regardless of any local ordinances or anything like that. The burden and the responsibility for complying with the law is on the consumer, as well as with the manufacturers that make sure their products meet the standards that are set forth?
That's my understanding, yes, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Yeah, I think that's the answer. See, how, just a curiosity.
Right. It sounds like it's a consumer.
How come you're carrying a seven-county metro? we're all in this together, I know, but which is fine. I know. Okay, Senator Bonner, you don't have to answer that one.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, and Commissioner, I appreciate the intent behind the bill. I'm concerned, though, you know, we are in this budget crisis, and so one of the things that I've been focused on as I've read different legislation, reviewed, heard is, you know, are we doing things to fix the budget problem, to remove mandates from our local units of government? Are we placing more mandates on people in a time when we're trying to do more with less? And I'm not sure that it's our job to pass a law dictating the kind of bags our customer or our citizens are putting their yard waste in it. For example, the city of Minnetonka, I know they, as a service, they pick up, you know, a certain number of times a year yard waste. Do you have any idea which cities, whether they have a rule about what bags? I don't think they do. But
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Senator Bonoff, if I can address your concerns. We've scaled back our testimony quite a bit today for your committee, but in the environmental committee, we really went into this with a PowerPoint and the whole nine yards. And there is a PowerPoint that you might have that shows some photographs towards the back of compost in bags and stuff, and it looks, you know, that's kind of that sample that had the plastic in it. There's no real value to that to sell as a compost. But the other material, which can be sold as a landscaping material, there's a higher value to that. So the net result is the recycling cost, there may be a higher cost to the hauler initially, but there's a recyclable product in the end that's sellable. So there's a gain because you've got a product that can be sold. And like that picture shows, that material is not worth anything there because of all the plastic mixed into it. But with the biodegradable bag where it breaks down to a good compost, then that, as Commissioner Reinhardt alluded to, there is a demand for landscapers to use that product. So so there's a higher value to the end product. So hopefully that would offset if there's any other higher costs. And also one of the reasons that I am carrying this bill is that they were looking in one of my counties for one of these composting sites, and some of our planning commissioner members from the county had toured one that looked very similar to that, and they had told me about plastic everywhere and that, you know, they didn't really want something like that in the county. So I do have some concerns about, you know, this material that can be used into a really good recyclable product or something that's really just not a reusable product with the plastic in it. Does that address your concerns that there's a higher value to it if it's a sellable, recyclable compost at the end?
Senator Olsen, Mr. Chair, Senator Bonif, if I can add to that. The other side of it is from the consumer standpoint. And there are cities in the state, City of Hutchinson being one, that implemented a compostable film program back in 2001. To the consumer, the bags cost about 17 cents a piece, where a lot of your lawn and leaf bags, if you go to a retailer, will cost 50 to 75 cents, sometimes more than a dollar. So the material cost to the consumer is actually a net wash, basically. They can hold more material. They're easier for the transporters to haul. And if you look at this picture with all the plastic, many of the compost facilities actually employ people simply to cut the bags open and dump the compost out. So that's an added cost to them that they would be able to avert if this was to be put into law. And at the same time, I believe Section 1 calls for either paper, compostable plastic, or loose carrying, such as the City of Minneapolis is talking about.
You know what you ought to develop?
I'm ready.
A bottle for water. I bet 15 to 20% of the landfills have this yuppie bottled water. It's filling them up.
I believe Ms. Sparks.
Do it thicken your product up so it breaks down? And I mean, the bottled water, what do they last for, 5,000 years in the landfills?
I believe the bottle that's sitting next to you is made by NatureWorks. It's a biodegradable resin.
Is it? So there,
yes.
Well, okay.
Needs to be.
Well, you ought to amend your. Now we're on to something. Yeah, we're going to amend where these bottles that fill up the landfills.
So Chairman,
and if you
Chairman.
Don't do this, it's a penny tax per bottle of water. What would that bring in our state?
Mr. Chairman?
A penny, just for water.
Mr. Chairman?
Water you can get out of the tap. Pepsi Cola you can't, so we're going to let them alone for a while.
Mr. Chairman, is that a question?
Yes.
$24 million a year.
There you go.
It's already double at the 2 cents.
We've already,
$48
million. We've already looked.
I'm not the biggest environmentalist in this building, but that just bugs the hell out of me. Everybody's got to have bottled water.
Hey, Mr. Chairman.
St. Paul water is not that good, say, Commissioner, but what the hell? We'll drink it up here. We don't need to go in and get the.
Yes, Senator Tabazzoli.
Mr. Chairman. What did you do this weekend? I was first, actually, because I asked you a long time ago. But I got to tell you a little story about bottled water because I was at a restaurant here, and the waiter walked up with a bottle of water and a pitcher of water, and he said, would you like tap water or would you like bottled water? And I said, sir, everybody knows tap water is better for you. And he said, yeah. He said, the name Evian, spelled backwards, is naive. Anyway, so how do you like that one? What my question is in this bill, on line 2.7, and maybe this is for Mr. Fuller. Do we generally tell the Attorney General if they can bring action in a bill? It seems to me that this is, first of all, permissive language until you get to the end where then it has to. They have to abide by Section 8.31, Subdivision 2. So I don't know if we say in bills that the Attorney General may bring action. Is that something that we do, or I don't? We do that? Yeah? We have to tell the Attorney General they can bring action?
Mr. Fuller.
Yeah, exactly.
Senator Saltzman.
Yes. On the earlier point, Mr. Chair, when you talked about the cost of this, and to that point, is that my question was, and I think you started to address it, was that what is the cost when we put all of our yard waste into these plastic bags that don't decompose, and then we're paying people to rip them open? Why are we even trying to recycle? So I guess I would support this bill because I think it really follows through on if we're asking people to collect this waste, that it should be just kept in our yards. But if you do, you know, have it in these bags, that, you know, we should have a way for them to recycle this as easily as possible. So I think that your point about the cost, I know that each of our collectors use a different procedure as to if you're charged for your waste, if the city collects it. Every municipality is very different. But I think having the uniform law that if we're going to have this waste, I think it is cheaper to have it done so that you can just, you know, drop the waste, punch the bag, leave it in with the landfill, than having all of these bags flying around. So I do support this.
Senator, we'll see.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for Mr. Fuller. And that's on line 1.14. He had expressed a concern about using the term materials generated in a metropolitan county. And I would like to hear what his concern is on that at this point, because if he's concerned, I'd like to straighten that out.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to know what was intended, because as it reads now, and I'm understanding that's probably what you want, since you said that the transfer stations may be outside of the county. So you're talking about whoever loads a bag in this area has to file. This doesn't make any – so if somebody – from outside this area brings a bag into the metropolitan county, that's okay. So you're just looking at that activity, which is filling a bag with that yard waste, irrespective of where it's disposed.
Correct.
Then it's fine.
Okay. Thank you.
So you're cleaning up our act here in the cities, right?
I'm looking down on you from the north.
It doesn't even.
Oh, we should do it statewide. No.
Hey.
Oh, we've got to, yeah. It's a good idea. It's good for everybody. Senator Bottom's got an amendment.
Mr. Chair, Senator
Olson. I don't wish it upon you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, this doesn't count for your area?
No, actually, it is true that part of my district is in the metropolitan area, so yes.
Yeah, two blocks.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I just want to check with my local units of government and find out, you know, how they feel about it.
Senator Skoy, we got everybody's attention.
Mr.
Here.
Chair, Senator Olson, I'm going to give you a little help in this regard. This is an effort to equalize the land use bills that all the metropolitan legislators pass that impact us in greater Minnesota.
Thank you. Good shot.
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy.
All right, we're stretching today, are we?
We are. I'm seeing with this bottle charge, we're going to take care of the deficit, and we're covering a lot of ground today. So, but I think
more ground with yard waste.
Yeah, more ground. So I do think that this is a good bill, and it will help, this yard waste problem come out with a material that is really a nice usable material in the end. And
Senator Carlson, what's your bottle made out of? You know, is that biodegradable?
Mr. Chair, yes, I believe that is biodegradable. It does not have a recycle.
How about the cap
on it?
The cap, I mean, that's a smaller part of it, but
the cap would not be biodegradable.
Okay, let's get on to Senator Rosen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Olson, the standard specification, is there a fee to gain that specification or that approval? Is there a fee? Do you know?
I am going to pass that off to the expert here.
Senator Olson, yes, there is. Actually, there's an independent agency called BPI, which is a Biodegradable Plastics Institute, that there's a couple of different places that will do the testing, but there is a fee to gain the approval. And as of right now, I believe there's over 30 manufacturers that have that certification and are allowed to use the compostable logo.
Mr. Chair, do you know what the fee is?
I would be guessing to give you an exact number, but it's in the range of $1,000 to $3,000.
That's a pretty big range.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
We just decided to add Austin and Albert Lee.
It's good for one.
Okay, any further discussion on? We have a motion. Where does it have to go? Anywhere else, Senator?
Mr. Chair, our next stop will be judiciary because we do have some
penalties and stuff. Boy, we're too easy this committee today. Everything's flying out of here. Well, you haven't passed yet, though, have you? who's making the motion? Senator Saltzman?
I guess we did already.
Senator Latz, Senator Scoy, Senator Botiff, Carlson, going once. Senator Latz, going twice. Senator Latz moves the bill to the Judiciary Committee.
We get the amendment?
As amended, yeah. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much.
Senator Bach.
The bill is out of here, Mr. Chairman. Is it unusual for us to do a delete everything amendment when it's been through a previous committee? I thought delete everything's were kind of for the committee of origin.
Yeah, we just did it. Senator Ropes. Is that a good answer? Senator Erickson Ropes, you have the last bill, number 4, Economic Development Authority, which I cut off half of the. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. It's good to hear that the bills are flying out of this committee.
You're not out of here yet. Okay, go ahead.
To present another one. I have a great another bill. This is following up a bill I've carried in the past. This is in the past has been a bipartisan bill dealing with clean renewable energy. Winona County began. Well, first, I have a A1 amendment. Do you want me to put that?
Yeah, we can pass it out.
Okay. It's my first committee stop, so this is the A1.
Okay, what is you can start explaining the amendment.
Okay. Well, I'll give you just a little backup on the project first, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair.
It's all right. Yep.
Winona County began working on a community winds project in 2005, and they were the first county in the state to try to own and operate a wind turbine. And being the first county, they were running into all sorts of little glitches, and one of them became apparent that cities had the authority to own and operate wind turbines. School districts had the authority, but counties weren't given the authority. So I carried a bill in 2007 that would allow Winona County to own and operate a wind turbine. And then the next year, I believe Senator Kubley carried a bill saying all counties could own and operate wind turbines. So Winona County has been moving forward in ways to finance a wind turbine. And that structure has gone through a couple permutations. The first one, they tried to do a joint powers agreement, and then the second approach to financing was they decided they were going to try to be the sole owner, and that didn't work out. So finally they're to the point where they are looking at the only way for Winona County to succeed with this project is to use the Minnesota FLIP model, which I understand is it requires the creation of an LLC, which was not an option at the first time I carried the bill. And counties at this point cannot enter into LLCs with private equity investors. However, the Winona County EDA has the authority to enter into an LLP. But since LLPs can't take advantage of the tax credits and other benefits, we are putting forward a change that would allow Winona County to enter into an LLC, and we're using a Mountain Iron template that's already been passed. So there's my bill.
What did Kubley's bill do? It allowed
Kubley's bill extended authority for all counties in the state
not to go LLCs though.
To get in on wind turbines.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. I get it.
So now we're talking about the funding mechanism, and the way the Minnesota FLIP model has been explained to me is that it allows entities like counties to partner up with private investors, and those private investors would provide 99% of the upfront costs for over 10 years, and at the end of the 10 years, they flip the ownership to the county. So we would like to get homegrown renewable energy going down southeastern Minnesota to be owned eventually by the county, but to operate through this LLC as a funding mechanism.
This is good for your county.
It should be good for all counties.
Should be good for all counties, right?
Yes.
But we're doing, you're taking care of your county today.
Well, that's how we started out first. We sort of blazed the trail, and then Kula came in and spread out through
the
state.
Blazed the trail. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Erickson Ropes, the credit you're talking about is the federal production tax credit. Is that correct?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. And, Mr. Chair, to be similar to Senator Tomassoni's, Senator, does this involve the seabed community-based?
Yes, I believe that they are, yes, it's the seabed community projects.
Okay, Mr. Chair, one more thank
Senator
you.
Rosen.
Senator Erickson Ropes, is this tower required to be in Winona County, or is it going to be in some other site outside the county and the county will just have ownership of it?
This particular tower, the site, the best site that they've chosen is, in fact, within the county.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Senator Erickson Ropes, I love it. I have no problem with the bill. It's just real interesting. Winona County, you have the first wind tower legislation coming down the pipeline. And someday I would like to know why Winona County has their own workforce development, and they don't have to share it with other counties. I did not pick up on that, Mr. Chair, when it came to committee, but you're like singled out all by yourself there.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Senator,
that was an unrelated question.
Yes, it was.
Senator
totally.
Bonner.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Erickson Ropes, I like this bill because I think, pursuant to what I said when the last bill was up, is that during these tough times, we should look at every policy from the lens of, is this going to do something good, create jobs, move us forward? And this does. And I would say, though, wouldn't we be smarter? Wouldn't the better public policy be to allow all the counties to proceed in this fashion rather than have to go on a county-by-county basis? I'm not suggesting an amendment, but I'm just wondering if that wouldn't be the more appropriate public policy than to carve out exceptions.
We're going to wait till Senator Bach leaves the room, then we're going to move this right to the floor. Yeah, that's a good point.
Mr. Chair, it sounds like looks like Senator Bach does not agree. I don't know.
Senator Bonoff, if it's a good idea, and we'll find out what tax implications there are relative to an LLC versus current law. I suspect this probably fits in the public finance article of the omnibus tax bill, and we will take a look at, if it's a good idea and there aren't some major tax implications at broadening it.
Yeah, we have to encourage it. Any part of the puzzle that will help us get there and... So, Senator Bach, we appreciate that. Look at it.
No, it's not, Mr. Chairman.
Because it is a jobs thing, and it's very important statewide and for jobs plus the energy conservation. Senator Thomas, honey.
Mr. Chairman, I don't remember the title of the bill that I had here. But I'm thinking this probably has to come to my committee also when it says Economic Development Authority.
There's a price tag.
I don't know if mine said
Mountain
that.
Iron.
Iron, did it say Economic Development Authority on it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, if it didn't come to my committee, then this doesn't have to go there either, but it definitely has to go to taxes, I found out today.
Can I leave now, Mr. Chair?
I found out today. You didn't find out any of that tax implications before this meeting, did you?
No, Mr. Chair, and we're prepared to have that tuned up by the time we get to the next committee.
Senator Rosen, boy,
you,
a lot
Mr.
of people
Chair.
Want to look at this. That's good.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator, did this come to energy and I missed it?
No.
No, okay. Mr. Chair, that would be another committee you'd have to go to. And just in response to making it statewide, which I think is very doable and a great idea, We'd have to make sure that the utilities are okay with that. But you clearly did in your amendment state that it cannot be sold or, you know, and what did it say? May not sell, transmit, or dispute the electrical energy at retail. And that's smart. So.
And, Mr. Chair, to the utilities question for Senator Rosen, we've gone through that in previous years when we got first permission to get this up and running. It was the whole resale, wholesale conversation we had with utilities, and they actually supported the bill because, you know, we're just going to keep it within Winona County, and any excess gets sold back, you know, to the utility companies. So that's all fair and square.
We'll move it out of here probably with just your county in, but I think we want to take a longer look or in the next couple of committees to see if, because we don't, it's an uncertainty about the tax thing. That's why we can't add them all today. But okay. I think we can pass yours
Mr.
out.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to expand it to the whole state. It's a good thing.
If it makes sense, I mean, it's not Mr. Chairman, a huge price to take.
I'll leave this up to the chair, but this is basically the same bill that I had.
Pretty close, yep.
It said Molten Iron. And that came through Senator Solon's committee first before it got to this committee. So I don't know if this one has to go to Senator Solon's committee or not. But I would think that it probably does before it goes to taxes.
The only thing I can add
not
is that
I'm trying to create any problem here, but the bill's changed quite a bit from this to this. So.
Yeah, she hasn't. Maybe they haven't asked for it, but.
Well, that's because they didn't see the delete all. No.
Oh, I guess I've been informed that they do want it, so.
Okay.
Somebody, we should have Senator Carlson wants to move the amendment for Senator Erickson Ropes. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Now, which committee first?
Energy.
Energy. Okay, would somebody want?
I'll move that.
As amended, Senate File 450 as amended. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails.
Thank you.
Okay, good work, members. Very good work.